Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we get people from around the world to tell you how they saw the news from the past month or so. This is episode number 41 for November 2011. Hello everyone and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is the show where we gather many, many people from around the world. We tell them we're meeting on Skype on this day, at this time, and they show up and we discuss the news. Except sometimes they don't show up and we just get Tom. How's it going, Tom?
I am the world.
So we were supposed...
I feel bad. Well, I don't feel bad, but, you know, I have done this to you before where I was supposed to show up and then I overslept and forgot and spaced out. So I was making sure that I didn't forget and that I was here this morning. And I was actually looking forward to chatting with Turkey. I haven't had a chance to be on the show with him in a while. I always enjoy conversing with him. So I'm sorry he's absent.
Yeah. So, you know, that Saudi guy, I always knew he was going to sabotage my November show.
You mean Saudi-tage?
Took me a second to get it there.
Because it didn't make any sense, that's
yeah,
why.
probably. He might show up during the show. It's happened to him before.
I hope so.
But we're not going to count on him, and we're going to have sort of a... mini show. It probably isn't going to be as long as it usually is, and we're still going to have him on the show somehow, because we're at some point going to be talking about Turkey Day, except it's spelled different.
Except not Turkey Day, but yeah. Turkey.
So for those who don't know, his name is spelled with an I at the end, and it's very funny when I get emails talking about Turkey with an EI, because I always think about the, you know, lovely stuffed animal you Americans eat for Thanksgiving. All right, so we'll get to Turkey Day at some point, and the fact that that name annoys me to no end. But first of all, there's serious things happening in the U.S. Not in the U.S., in the world. And I guess, so for the past few months, we've been talking regularly about the Arab Spring, of course, and the revolutions and all of that. And most of the important events in the world, I feel, have been the continuation of that trend. There's, of course, the revolution sort of restarting in Egypt. The Arab countries getting sort of tough on Syria more than I would have expected them to, and I think that sentiment is shared in many places. And then there's the Moroccan, can you say that? Moroccan?
Yeah,
elections,
sure.
That are taking place this very weekend.
And don't forget the concessions in Bahrain and Yemen.
That's, yeah, absolutely. And you know, leadership is starting to get eclipsed by the constant, you know, the unrelentness. That's also a word I'm not sure exists.
Unrelenting, I think,
right. Yeah. Resolve of the people. So I don't know if we can, you know, let's go scattershot and discuss whatever you think is appropriate amongst all of these topics, which are very much linked. So I've been talking about this for a few months. Maybe you want to give us your view on it and the way it's been reported on in the U.S. in the past few weeks.
Sure. I mean, when you add in the Occupy protests in the United States and also elsewhere around the world, the entire planet is sort of like in the game of civilization when you haven't been keeping your cities happy enough, and all of a sudden they're all in revolt and production goes down. And I mean, it really is a real world representation of that. We have not been keeping people happy. There is bad economics, bad economic conditions, and repression, and people are done with it in all manners of life. So you always ask me, how is it being reported in your part of the world? And I always respond that I'm a horrible representation of
that.
Everyone
says
I don't watch television news at all. Not Not at all. Not one little bit. I don't read local newspapers except for hyperlocal, like my neighborhood newspaper that tells me about like what's actually going to affect the water and the local events and the mayoral election. So I don't get that sort of local, like, oh, this is what Fox News is saying about it sort of thing, because I read the BBC and the Daily Telegraph and
The
Economist.
Fox News.
You do?
No. We always, at some, you know, I guess, it, you know, it's the polarized view in the U.S. and there's Fox News
and everyone
else.
Well, it's the most popular news. It's the most popular news channel. So if you were to say, like, how is something being reported in the U.S., you would look to Fox News and say, well, they're the most popular news channel. They're the one everybody watches for the most part. You know, whatever they're saying about it is going to be what most people in the U.S. hear.
But I guess it is one, but don't they have the way I see the situation, the news situation in the U.S. is that there's Fox News on one side, which usually have quite an extreme view on things, and then there's everyone else. So sure, Fox News is one channel, is probably the most watched, but if you add up all the other ones, they might combine into something more watched than Fox News alone. Is that...
I don't know what the numbers are. And Fox News is not that extreme. If you take Hannity and Beck, well, Beck's gone, but if you take their columnists out of the equation and just talk about their news, their newscasts are probably from a perspective, for sure. But if you were to just watch a normal Fox newscast of the straight stories of the day, you wouldn't call it extreme. I think... No. Does it have a slant? Sure, but it's not extreme. It's Hannity and Combs and O'Reilly and those guys who are responsible for Fox News getting the so-called extreme tag applied to him. I don't even think O'Reilly's all that extreme, really. He's firmly on one side.
It's funny because I don't have Fox News here, and so the way I know Fox News is all those, you know, 2-minute clips videos.
The examples of the slant. Yeah. And you never see examples of the straight ahead stories. I mean, all these folks working for Fox News used to work for CBS and NBC and ABC. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not ideologues the way the commentators are.
I guess, well, to be honest, it's not just that, though. It's whenever you talk to people, at least, you know, maybe I know some slanted people, but usually people agree that Fox News is not the kind of channel that, not even politically, that doesn't represent their views, but that they think is not objective or doesn't even try to be objective. They try to push an agenda as a whole channel. So maybe, you know, it's not just
at it from a media studies sort of approach, which is there isn't a channel out there that doesn't have a perspective. And it's very clear what Fox News's perspective is, but you use the word extreme, and I don't think their perspective is extreme. Their perspective that they report on is Republican, and I think that's fair to say. But it's not necessarily Tea Party. At least again, and this is what's complicated about it: the Fox News news reporting versus the Fox News commentators is Glenn Beck. Oh yeah, he's extreme. Absolutely. And like I said, not on the channel anymore. Is O'Reilly extreme? You could make the argument. I don't really think he's that extreme, but he's far to the right, for sure. He at least can be reasonable. You know, he can sit down with the president and have a civil conversation.
Right.
I'm not sure that Glenn Beck would be possible for him to do that. So, yeah, I think Fox News as a whole gets that argument because they have entertained and encouraged those more extreme positions, if you will. The same way MSNBC could be considered extremely left because they have commentators who do shows like Rachel Maddow who are far to the left. But that doesn't mean that MSNBC or NBC News is extreme. MSNBC News has a perspective that is slightly liberal.
It's just that the guys that are far to the left seem so much more reasonable.
Well, if you're from my point of view, beliefs tend their way, of course
yeah,
they do.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, I understand, but that, you know, it's I guess we're veering off from the topic of the topics of the month, but we were discussing socialism with Scott last month, with Scott in Turkey, and I was trying to say, you know, the fact that socialism has become such a bad word in the U.S. is very strange to us, because socialism is not that far from, you know, there's a very clear distinction between socialism and communism, and we also consider communism crazy. Well,
right.
Okay, maybe not, you know, it might be a little bit different, but socialism is just, it's still a market based economy and they are very similar. The doctrines of socialism are quite close to the doctrines of capitalism as it is implemented in our Western countries. And the other thing that I wanted to mention at that point was, it's strange to me that there's such a hatred towards left-wing views, because, and maybe even you can put that argument in the, you know, you can get the argument the other way around, but because, honestly, it's not like no healthcare, for example. If you wanted to not have socialist healthcare, things would be better in the, you know, it. God, I'm not even making sense. So basically, in the healthcare debate in the U.S., it was like, socialist healthcare is the bane of existence, and our way is so much better, and you know, it works better. Sure, maybe you don't get healthcare, but you keep your money. And the thing is, even that for me, that argument doesn't make sense at all. Not just because it's unfair, or you know, we don't. It's not some kind of hippie argument that we have to be fair and help people. It's that your system of unabashed capitalism with no government interaction whatsoever, or at least, you know, what you would like to do. When I say you, I mean mostly Republicans in your country. It doesn't yield better results. Like, healthcare costs a lot more in America than it does in European countries, and it doesn't have better results on the country's health. So even the argument that it would cost too much to the country doesn't really stand. And in that sense, I'm bringing it back to the argument about Fox News and the left slant and on MSNBC. For me, when you look at the numbers and sort of, you know, as much as you can on at the facts, it seems that the reasonable argument is usually to be made against the views that Fox News defends and that the Republicans defend, at least in some areas. And I don't understand why it's being demonized so much. And maybe I'm not seeing the demonization of the right wing on MSNBC, but it exists as well. Does what I'm saying make sense? Or
yeah, well, there's a million things going on with what you're talking about. I mean, the reason socialism has become the naughty word in the United States is because we lost the word communism. All the debates in the 80s were pretty much the same as they are now, but with communism in place of the word socialism. But communism fell, so you couldn't use it anymore. And some brilliant right-wing think tank came up with the idea, hey, it's the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and we've never been, you know, favor of socialism on our side anyway, so let's just push that one as basically the same thing. So they slotted that into the rhetoric. So that's just a rhetorical trick that's going on, and a lot of people.
So when they say socialism, they actually mean communism.
Well, they don't mean anything. They mean the thing I don't like. When they were talking about communism in the 80s, they actually weren't talking about communism. They were talking about big, scary, insulting word that I'm going to tar my opponent with. And that's all they mean by socialism now. Because there are so many socialist aspects of the United States government, some of which are criticized by the Republicans and some aren't. The socialist aspect of supporting corn prices and continuing to subsidize farming is very strongly supported by the Republicans. That is entirely socialist But you would never hear them admit to that. It's a, it's just rhetoric. It's not, it's not based in any kind of fact.
Right.
So anyway, I think what's going on in the United States is we have reached a fever pitch that was made emblematic in the super committee negotiations, right? We can't even get a committee set up with every advantage to come to an agreement. They didn't have to cut much money, relatively speaking.
I don't know what that is, the super committee.
I'm sorry, let me back up and explain then. The super committee was set up by the president to cut 1.2 I want to say billion dollars, but I think it was $1 trillion. Essentially less than 5% of the budget. To find savings and reduce the deficit by a very small percentage.
That must be billions then, because
and the super committee was made of equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats. They would whatever they decided would be put up to a majority vote, so there would be no chance of parliamentary maneuvers, no filibustering. Basically, as long as the Senate approved it 50%, it would get passed. And there's a very severe repercussion of them not coming to agreement, which is that automatic cuts across the board would happen, including everybody's favorites. So whether it was entitlements like Social Security, whether it was defense, everything would get cut across the board. Nobody wants that. So they had all the motivation to succeed. They had all the pathway eased, and they really didn't even have to cut that much money, relatively speaking. They couldn't come to an agreement. The two sides just would not budge.
When did that happen?
That happened over the weekend in the U.S. Okay. So, I'm sorry, not over the weekend. That happened on Tuesday, I think. They finally agreed. They hit their deadline and said, we don't have an agreement. So now the automatic cuts go into place. The Republicans would not agree to even the slightest tax increase on anyone, including the richest. And the Democrats would not agree to any kind of restructuring or modification to entitlement programs. No matter what. And so they got nothing done. They couldn't compromise. And that, to me, is emblematic of the condition we are in, which is much worse than the 80s, in that the two sides just won't work with each other anymore.
How
and I think that has been encouraged by a system, a two-party system that, in my opinion, is really just a one-party system with two sides to it, that pushes you to nominate and elect the extremes in each party rather than the moderates.
How did how does the system push you to put someone who's extreme in place? Is it like the way the counties are divided, or is it what's the reason?
It's a couple things in my opinion. And again, this is just my opinion.
Sure.
The primaries that we have are institutionalized now. So it used to be that any party could come together and nominate someone and put them on the ballot, right? But what we've done now is we've institutionalized the two main parties, Republicans and Democrats. It's very difficult, not impossible, it's very difficult for the other parties to get someone on the ballot. It is law.
You're talking
in most
about
states.
The presidential election.
I'm talking about Congress and Senate.
Oh, okay. All right.
But also the presidential election. The two parties are guaranteed the spot on the ballot. They don't have to do anything except tell the folks who are the registrars, here's who our party is nominating. While other parties have to prove that they have enough support every election.
The two main parties would get it anyway. Is it really like
things? In other words, the reason I bring this up is that what they've done now is created a primary system that is also institutionalized. So the libertarians can go out and nominate their party member however they want, whereas the parties themselves have put themselves in a position where they're essentially running a governmental election, but only for people in their party. If you are a Democrat, registered as a Democrat, then you can vote for the Democratic member. If you're a Republican, you can vote the Republican. If you're an independent, you can, in some states, choose which party you want to vote for in the primary. But it's usually those people don't vote. So what you end up with is the most extreme members, the most dedicated members of each party vote in the primaries. And that encourages the more extreme views to prevail in the primaries, which means you get the more extreme candidates tend to get nominated for the final election. And because, and the reason I brought up the institutionalization of the two parties, you don't get third parties giving any kind of realistic competition to possibly moderate the votes. You get you get nothing on the other side.
But that's not because it's institutionalized.
Word.
Yes. Is it? I mean, a third party could theoretically, if it gathered enough support, it could still have a candidate on the ballot. And
oh, yeah, and they have candidates on the ballot. But because it's institutionalized with the two parties, nobody supports those other parties. It's just too difficult for them to gain enough acceptance to challenge. So all of the good talent in elections, all of the good talent for running for office, focus on the two parties because that pathway is easy.
So do you think
that's the pathway in?
Do you think there's a the country maybe with that super committee has reached a point where government is actually stuck and things just cannot happen, or is it just a view of things are horrible today, they weren't like that in the 80s, and you know, well, you always think like that?
No, that's a really good question. And just real quickly, the other side besides the primary system, which I think is also a reason we have these extreme sides, is what you mentioned about the way the voting districts are created.
Right.
They're created politically. So they're not created based on any kind of objective reality like population. They're carved up so that all the Democrats are in one district and all the Republicans are in another district, and they redistrict every so often to make sure that, you know, if a bunch of Republicans moved into one district, they redraw the borders, you know, to make sure that you're getting, again, the most extreme candidates for each side put into office. We see this in the state of California in the inability of our House of Representatives here, our assembly, to do anything with each other because they are so extremely separated in the state of California. And so, and we're suffering from that. And now the United States is suffering for that. And yeah, in some ways it is sort of a like, oh, well, the parties have already always been at each other's throats and they've always been bickering. So that's nothing new. But I do feel like it's gotten worse. The two-party system's defense has always been it causes compromise. It may cause a lot of overheated rhetoric, but in the end, you end up with something moderate because the two sides will come to a compromise in the end. Lately, they haven't. On healthcare, now with the super committee, there has been either one side just forcing their view through or no compromise at all in the case of the super committee. So now what we're looking at is the two sides can't compromise, and they're not getting anything done. And yeah, that happened in the 90s with Bill Clinton, and the government shut down briefly because of brinksmanship. So it's not like it never has happened before, but it really does seem to me like the older rhetoric was at least marginally, you know, respectful of the other side. And now it's not. And maybe it was worse in the 60s and the 50s. Some people have told me, you know, what during George Wallace's days in the United States, there were some very racist campaigns, and the civil rights movement was the same way. So it may be cyclical, and we're just going through that period again.
Right. Okay. And that is what the Arab countries have to look forward to in a, you know, couple dozen years.
Well, that, you know, honestly, the Arab countries really need to pay attention in setting up their government that they don't institutionalize these inefficiencies, that they do a modern version of democracy with ranked choice voting and proportional representation. And part of that is why the protesters are out in Tahrir Square, because they're unhappy with the constitution that the military has put forward that gives the military way too much independence.
Right, which too much control. And the thing we've been hearing the most about the reignition of the revolution in Egypt is basically the people are just both disappointed and very worried that the military is not going to abandon the power that they've had. They were told, we're here for 6 months, and we're going to organize the elections, and then we're going to leave. And it's been 9 months, so they're basically back on Tahrir Square to make sure to get them out. It's as if the events from a few months ago didn't even happen because the protests weren't interrupted. They just want to make sure that the revolution wasn't done for nothing, because if the military stays in place, it's just as if Mubarak had stayed.
And his cronies being put in place in positions of power and all of that. Yeah.
Exactly. And one of the issues that they're unhappy about is the fact that it was very interesting to hear this. It's really about age. One of the criticism that the protesters are telling us to explain why they're so unhappy is that it's old people. It's the old people that were in place before, and they want young, you know, obviously different people, but the way they're explaining it is, we don't want the old people. So that was something that sort of resonated a little bit with me, because in France, most of the time, I guess Sarkozy is kind of young.
I don't know, man. You're getting older. You might need to switch sides soon.
I am. Well, you know, I think at this point I'm still young enough that I would be considered young in politics. Maybe not in other areas, though.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was obviously, it's been doing being on the front pages for the past, I don't know, I guess week or so, when they started getting back into the Tahrir place. So that was... It's not like we're incredibly worried, because at this point there has been some issues and some, the military has been using excessive force, I guess you can say, and there's been incidents. But it seems like the military is sort of testing the waters here. And if they do get some pushback, they are going to maybe not go away, but at least give in to the demands of the protesters enough that they will be happy.
The military in Egypt, and I am far from an expert on this, but from my far away position, it seems like they are very tactical. They sensed which way the wind was blowing in the spring and quickly sided with the revolutionaries, the protesters. And that tipped the scales. But they knew that was to their advantage. Now, they pushed things a little too far, and you saw them immediately come out with an apology for overuse of force, which I thought, well, most militaries, if they're really, you know, hell-bent on taking over, would have seen that as a sign of weakness. But the Egyptian military really seems to be like, okay, we pushed that a little too far. Let's back off. Let's try to gain, you know, support for the elections. There is a separate protest. I don't know how legitimate or how big it really is, but it's being reported that there's another protest in support of the elections. The Muslim Brotherhood is not protesting. They're supporting the election. So it's
very
less
tactical too.
Exactly. But it's less overwhelming than it was in the spring, right?
Because as you're saying, the military is doing what sort of maybe the minimum, but still the required minimum to keep things in control.
Exactly. It's very tactical. So I think this is birth pangs in a way of a democracy. But the only thing that really concerns me is that the Constitution gives no civilian supervisory powers over the military at this point.
Sure.
And that's what has to change.
Yeah, and that is it's really complicated matter, though, because in these countries, I mean, at least in Egypt, the military also represents a large part of the economic strength of the country. You know, a lot of the industries are owned by the military, so you can't really put them out of everything easily. Or even quickly, even if you wanted to institutionally, it's very difficult to do. And the other thing that you're mentioning is the Islamist parties, which are being very quiet all of a sudden, and everyone wants the election to take place very soon, as it was planned. And the Islamist parties have gone very quiet and are just keeping their heads down, and because they know that they will most probably get the majority of the votes. And it's the same thing in Morocco, which has been reported on quite extensively in France also in the past week, which is everyone expects the Islamist parties to be elected. And that's no surprise for, you know, for anyone, because in these countries, it's, yeah. And one of the reasons, this is where, you know, there is sort of ambivalent feelings, because in Egypt, one of the reasons why the military is holding on to the power and making things a little bit muddy is that they know that the Islamist parties will get into power once the elections actually happen. And there were some terms in the constitution about the nature of the government. Is it, you know, democratic? Is it I can't remember the precise terms, but it was about whether, basically the crux of the issue was, could the Islamists, once in power, make it into an Islamist, you know, a Muslim government? And in Egypt,
a religious state,
right? Exactly. And the military doesn't want that to happen. So in that sense, coming from, at least from France, where we're all, you know, atheists, Luddites, we see this as, okay, of course we want democracy and freedom, but on the other hand, if the Islamists get into power, what's going to happen to that democracy and freedom? Now, it seems like the government should represent the population, and obviously the population is going to vote for them. So there's really nothing you can do. You can just hope that the system is going to evolve and the democracy is going to evolve into something more, you know, that tends towards freedom rather than oppression. But it's still a concern, I guess, is what I'm saying. And it's being mentioned sort of in a hush-hush way, in even in the French media. You know, we're not coming out right saying, oh my God, Islamists are going to take over the governments in these countries, but it's still being mentioned with concern, I guess.
I think in the United States there are probably some outlets that are saying that Egypt is going to be taken over by Islamic extremists. I don't hear it myself, but I see enough people in conversations on things like Google Plus and Twitter saying it, that it must be out there. It must be being pushed out there, because while it is a concern, it's far from a foregone conclusion. And even if an Islamist party gets in control, that doesn't mean an extremist government is immediately taken hold. I mean, Morocco just elected an Islamist party, and everyone thinks that it was good because it's not the party that the king wanted, right?
Yeah, so absolutely.
The Republicans and Democrats in the United States could be considered Christian parties because they espouse, you know, most of their candidates go to church and espouse Christian beliefs, but they're not extremist religious parties.
I think in the case of these governments in the Arab countries, you would expect the parties to enact laws that are, you know, that follow principles of the Muslim faith. In that sense, they would be more religious parties than, I guess there are a couple
of
issues.
You mean like some parties in the Western world want to enact abortion laws based on their religious beliefs?
That's what I was sure you were going to go to, because it's accurate. But I mean, there are a couple of sticking issues in the West that are, yes, probably
it's certainly
motivated
more secular
by,
in the West.
By, yeah, than, exactly.
Yeah, I will grant you that for sure. Mm.
But so the feelings towards these are very ambivalent. So, because on one side we want freedom for them, but on the other side, if by the freedom they acquire, they go and elect a sort of oppressive government, or that could become oppressive, or at least restrict freedoms, it's sort of difficult to accept as well. So, but well,
there's
still
a secular example of this in Russia.
In what way?
In that they had the freedom to elect a party, and they elected a very restrictive party.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah. And that is obviously an issue. I guess this is – we come back to the Constitution and what that means for the government that is going to be elected in the future. And that is one of the reasons why they are being very careful in Egypt about what they say for – about religion in government and on the state. And I guess it, one of the things that was very surprising, not very surprised, but somewhat surprising, was the way that the Arab countries are dealing with the issue in Syria. Because they are being very, I think, it's the I'm going to speak for myself here. It's the first real memory that I have of the first time that I can actually say that the Arab League and the Arab governments are acting strongly on a matter that is not directly related to oil prices. And it's entirely possible that I'm completely wrong and that I really don't know that much about it. But
yeah.
It's probable.
No, I don't mean that you are wrong. I mean, like, I feel the same way
okay,
when I start making pronouncements about this region, for sure.
But, yeah, at least the way we're discussing it here is it's almost like, okay, should we do something about Syria? Should we, like, what can we do? Like, economic sanctions? Should we do this or that? Of course, we're not going to send men on the ground, although now this is sort of almost being discussed with a buffer zone with Turkey and things like that. And then all of a sudden, we turn around and it's like, oh, so the Arab League is taking care of it. All right, cool. Excellent. Go ahead. It's your, you know, you do it.
Yeah. Oh, I feel the same way as you as far as, you know, I don't want to pretend to understand all the undercurrents and the stories behind the story in that region. But it seems to me that the various protests that began in the Arab Spring have had an effect on the governments in the Arab League. And it seems to me they're looking at Syria saying, you are a bad example right now. We need you to keep your population under control because we don't want this to spread and get worse in our countries. So we're going to put the hammer down on you.
Oh, so you think the reason is they want the revolutions to stop. So they're like, all right, you do what they say because they're not going to go back home, obviously. And then everyone's happy and we can, you know, keep doing what we do.
I think there's an element. Obviously, it's a very complex motivation that drives them. But I think an element of it is if you mess this up in Syria, it could spread and get worse.
Well,
and
where can it spread, though? I mean, it's pretty much sure you have countries where, you know, you don't exactly have the freedoms or the freedom of the Western world still in the Arab countries. But it's not like you have horrible dictator tyrants at this stage, I don't think. You know, it's still more or less,
no,
maybe
but,
not democratic.
I mean, yeah, you look at Yemen, you look at Bahrain, you look at some of these other countries that are now having their own protests. Look at Morocco. They're mild by comparison with Egypt, but they're bubbling up. And Saudi Arabia is looking at its population, you know, with a kind of wary eye, like you have no reason to protest, right?
If only we had someone from that land
to inform
us on
Turkey
that situation.
Right.
All right. Yeah, so I guess it's still, you know, the main conversation in most newscasts. And it's been the case for a few weeks and a few months, obviously. But I think at this point we're reaching, at least the view we have of Syria, it's like, it's just a matter of time now. There's no way they can keep it up for a long time, especially with the Arab League being so forceful on the issue. So, and as you were saying, Bahrain and, you know, all the countries where you had a strong dictator have been more or less dealt with by their population. And Syria is the last one. And after that, so of course you're going to have elections with probably Islamist parties. But we're reaching the end of that very tumultuous year, and the result is probably the best one we could have hoped for, I think.
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, we could always hope for even better, but probably the best we could expect.
Yeah, well, you know, at this stage, I don't know really what we could have reasonably hoped for other than this.
Utopias.
Sure. and that's pretty much the largest part of the news.
In the United States, the large part of the news is how great Black Friday was for the economy because people spent a lot of money, and how the NBA has now reached an agreement and may start playing their basketball season again starting on Christmas Day.
All right, so you have to explain this to me. I've sort of been hearing about the fact that the NBA was basically disbanded because players were being... That's the way I sort of glanced at the news and the way I understood it. Players were being super greedy, and the NBA started negotiations, and when they saw it was going nowhere, they were like, okay, you don't want to do it? Fine, we're disbanding. That's it. No more NBA. Bye.
To put it in terms you can understand, think of the NBA as the metro and the players in the NBA as the people of Paris. And the owners of the NBA and the workers came to a disagreement, and there was a general strike.
Okay.
Because that's what happened. It was a strike. They basically, I don't know if it was a lockout or a strike. I honestly haven't really followed it that closely.
Okay.
But they suspended the season. They said, well, fine, we can't come to an agreement on your contract, so we're not going to have the season.
What did they want, though? They wanted more money, or?
It's always what they want. They want better terms. Hmm. Not even just more money. It's essentially the players want... Again, I'm the worst person to be asking about this because I haven't followed it one little bit. All I know is the season got suspended.
Okay.
But I've followed enough other sports leagues that I can guess that what these are always about is the owners want more restrictions on what the players can do. They want salary caps. They want things that keep the price of the players down. And the players always want more free agency, the ability to change their teams whenever they want and shop around and get the best deal, you know, and drive up the price. And there's all kinds of other side things about, you know, negotiations for rights and this and that, but it always centers around free agency for the most part. And when they don't agree, either the players strike or the owners lock them out and say, well, if we can't agree on a contract with the union, then forget it. We're not going to do the season.
Okay. Obviously we're not big sports guys, basketball guys, but the question I can ask is, how is that it's a strike. It's workers going on strike to enforce their rights. And yes, the company has to shut down because of that strike, but it seems like a very socialist thing to do to get it back to where we were at the beginning.
It's a lockout in this case. I just looked it up.
Okay.
Which means, you know, the players were threatening to strike. But they couldn't come to agreement on a contract. And so this has been more common recently in the arena of sports, which is the league will then actually lock the players out and say, well, fine, if we don't have a deal, you can't play.
But I guess my question was, are people siding with the players, or is it regarded as a horrible, you know, communist action, or is it?
Yeah, usually people side with the owners in these things because the players are seen as greedy. And that's only because you have those players that are making millions of dollars,
right?
And people are like, oh, well, they're so greedy. You know, I want them to play. Now, with the trends to be less strike and more lockout recently, I don't know if the tide has turned.
What's the difference? I mean, okay,
a lockout means that the owners are the ones responsible for the cancellation of the season.
Okay.
A strike means that the players just won't show up. The owners are like, we'll play the season, but the players won't show up. And then sometimes you see replacement players and they try to do a season without the players. But lockout, which is what happened with the NHL last year and what happened with the NBA this year, is the owners saying, well, no, we're not going to hold the season until we get this settled.
And is it in the case of the players when the owners end up saying, all right, you won, you know, if that's what you want, lock out. Do they go, oh, crap, they actually did it? Okay.
Yeah, it's a negotiating tactic, exactly.
Mm, okay. All right. And I guess the other thing, which actually there's an interesting worldwide consequence of this, or at least I guess we saw it in France, is Turkey Day, Turkey with EY. Which the first thing I want to ask you about is, do people actually call it that incredibly ridiculous and annoying name of Turkey Day?
Yeah, I'd say less than 30% of the time you'll hear someone sort of jokingly say, have a good Turkey Day.
Okay.
It's called Thanksgiving by most people. But yeah, it's a nickname.
And people call it Turkey Day as a joke, like, haha, it's Turkey Day.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's fine then. Okay, in that case, I am not annoyed as
it's much. Not the official name, and and most people say Happy Thanksgiving.
Okay. They don't say happy, you know.
So this is something that you became aware of in France? They were covering Thanksgiving, or?
No. Actually, well, we've always known that you guys in the U.S. have this holiday called Thanksgiving. And interestingly enough, it's probably largely due to the fact that every single TV show portrays it somehow, especially sitcoms. You always have the Thanksgiving, you know. So we actually know about that tradition. We would know that you have Thanksgiving and it's a holiday, you know, where you eat turkey, but we actually know a lot more of the social significance of that holiday because of the TV shows.
Interesting.
I remember seeing, you know, Friends or other shows like that where it actually was very accurately. Well, I don't know about accurately, but what seemed accurate in the portrayal of
it is like a documentary. No, yeah.
No, but you know the fact that it's the time where you get with your friends and you get with your family and everything stops. That's another thing. You know, it's like, I'll get back to that. But you get with your family and you enjoy this long, very long weekend. And it's a sort of universal feeling, almost as much, if not more, than Christmas, where everyone seems to be on board with that. And you all do the Turkey Day thing.
Yeah, well, because there's no religious tie to Thanksgiving,
right.
even though it's actually very religious in its roots, because it's commemorating the pilgrims who were religious people fleeing Europe because of religious oppression, and they're landing in America and being helped out by the native population to have a fall harvest meal. That's what it's supposedly commemorating.
Yeah, how did that work out for the native population again?
Yeah, I call it, the reason for the season, ill-prepared colonists taking advantage of the natives and giving them smallpox. but that's, you know, that's neither here nor there in my example, which is Thanksgiving can be whatever you want. If you no one condemns you for not remembering the reason for the season. As long as you're thankful for something, that's all that's required of you.
Right.
So it's a very open holiday, and I think in some ways because of that, it's almost more popular, not more popular than Christmas by any stretch, but I don't know. It's more of a coming together feeling than Christmas, which has lately become this sort of debate about, well, don't say Christmas, say holiday. Oh,
yeah.
But now you're part of the war on Christmas. You know, it's become very politicized.
It seems like everyone loves Thanksgiving, I guess, is my impression.
Right. Yeah. No one says, oh, well, don't wish me a happy Thanksgiving. I'm Jewish. You know, it's Thanksgiving for everybody. It doesn't matter
usually
who you are, Muslim, atheist, Jewish, furry, doesn't matter. Thanksgiving is for all.
I guess the only people that would say don't wish me a happy Thanksgiving would be maybe the French or maybe everyone who's not
American.
Well,
yeah, right. But we also wouldn't do that. It's like, oh, well,
what?
You're not from
You
here.
Don't think I'm worthy of your wishing me a Thanksgiving?
I'm very thankful for you, okay. Patrick. And now I've offended you by being thankful.
But the other thing, there are two other things, but the other thing is, it seems like this year I've realized how big not just a celebration it is, but also a holiday. Everything stops on the Wednesday before. And it's basically almost like a Christmas, a month before Christmas.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of people often say, oh, the French, they're always on holiday. They never work, blah, blah, blah. It's like, you have two Christmases. What are you talking about?
Well, yeah, that's the little we get. Well, you get the entire month of August. You know, we get 2 days at the end of November. So give us a break.
Month of August. And you get vacation in August, don't you?
No.
Well, I mean, not in August, but like how many weeks of vacation do you get?
Most companies give employees around 2 weeks of vacation a year.
But that's when you first get into the company, doesn't it grow?
No, that's pretty much, I mean, sometimes it's less than that when you first get into a company, but it's around 2 weeks. If you've been with a company for a long, long time, you might get up to 3 weeks.
Wow. Okay, and is the week of Christmas separate from that, or if you want to be off for the week of Christmas?
You're given the 25th off separate. Okay. From your vacation. Sometimes you're given the 24th off, and you're given the first off.
Okay.
So there's some holidays.
Oh, yeah, but that's bank holidays. It's different. I mean, you don't get like a week off during Christmas, you know.
Most companies, no. Absolutely not.
Okay, then fine.
CNET.
Yeah.
And I don't know if CBS has continued this since I left, but CNET shut down between Christmas and New Year's because it saved them money.
How so?
Because there really isn't a lot of work that is done in that week. Mm. And so they realized, well, if we just tell everyone to stay away, we can lower the heat. We reduce the electrical footprint. And we save so much money on facilities that just give the stuff away. People work from home. We don't see a productivity dip.
You're not coming into the office, but you still work from home.
Well, it's one of those things where, like, you know, we're shut down between Christmas and New Year's, so don't come into work. But, of course, stuff happens, you know, and people answer emails. They're not working per se, but work just kind of never stops.
And since there's probably not a lot of news in that department, maybe.
Yeah, and the news people do come in. They have to because you know, the news has to be changed every day. But,
sure.
You know, the salespeople, the facilities people, the folks that are in the non-daily parts of the content system, all the engineers and programmers and all that, yeah.
So effectively, you only get 2 weeks a year? That's horrible.
You probably get effective 3 weeks with all the bank holiday type
stuff.
Oh, yeah,
but those are, you know, separate because we also get those.
There's 2 weeks of vacation that you can pick, and there's about a week of bank holiday.
But see, I have to be a little bit front and defend our system, though.
Uh-huh.
Because honestly, only 2 weeks is really, really low, as you were saying. You know, we get 5 weeks, plus all the bank holidays and other stuff even. But on the other hand, we still have a lot of, you know, we still have the same amount of work to do. So there are many studies that show that the French are actually more productive in these hours that they do work. No, well, maybe. But there is more, you know, we still have the same amount of work to do. It's not like magically a car doesn't get, you know, gets built faster because you have less you have more vacation. You still have to do that amount of work. I don't know. I guess there is... I'm going into assumption land, so I'm going to stop.
The dirty little secret is that you give people time off, but you don't reduce their workload, right? I mean, we were all talking about that earlier this week at Twit when we did two extra episodes of Tech News Today, and we recorded iPad Today early, and like all of our Thursday and Friday shows, we recorded them earlier in the week. So essentially, I mean, it wasn't quite the same amount of work as we would do, but essentially we were just stacking up all our work at the beginning of the week so that we could take 2 days off.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And it's it wasn't the same shows, and you know, TNT was like, you had the incoming special and stuff like that, but it's you still manage to produce the same amount of shows, so you effectively, I mean, I guess my if I had to put this into the form of a question, it would be, is there it's I'm answering my own question because I know the answer. There's a lot of slacking going on in every office in the world. And
sure.
I'm guessing that probably in France, since we have, let's say, I don't know, 20 or 30% more holidays, we get 20 or 30% less slacking because we have work to do. So
no, you just organize your slacking better and have it done on official days off.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I also think there's something to be said for the mental break of knowing you have days off.
Mm.
You know, it refreshes your mind much better than sort of just slacking off slowly, where you kind of feel slightly guilty that you know, it's better to give people time off and let them refresh their brain. Even if they have to do a lot of work to prepare for it. Anytime I go on vacation, when I come back, I'm absolutely in a different state of mind than I was when I left.
Sure.
Because I've given my brain a chance to reset. And I think that's undervalued by companies. The U.S. has this Protestant work ethic still, this tradition of if you're not working, you're lazy.
Yeah. And I think what you're proposing is more holidays for the workers in the U.S., and that's a socialist view, so you draw your own conclusion.
Well, it depends. Do I want the government to mandate the holidays, or am I saying that businesses should determine on their own that it is in their best interest to give their employees more days off?
I'm sure it's the case now. I'm sure if your employer wanted to give you 5 weeks of holiday, they could. It's not like the government would
CNET was very unusual in that respect. Like I mentioned, they shut down between Christmas and New Year's, which a lot of companies, in fact, when CBS came in, they immediately said they weren't going to do that, and everyone complained and they relented.
I like the microsecond pause between everyone and complained. It's like everyone complained.
Yeah. And so they reinstituted it. They said they'd review it each year to see if it was still worth it.
Mm.
But what CNET also did that CBS got rid of, CNET would give you an extra week of vacation if you kept your vacation balance less than 40 hours. And again, the reason for that was it cost them money on their balance sheet to have all this vacation, because when you quit or if you were laid off, they had to pay out all that vacation.
Right.
So it was in their best interest, again, to encourage you to keep less than 40 hours on the books.
Mm.
So you would get 3 weeks of vacation a year at CNET if you kept your vacation balance less than 40 hours at the end of every year.
Oh, interesting. And see, I guess I'm getting back to the it doesn't cost, it's not more efficient to do it like this, because it's not like your country has a perfect budget balance. You know, you're also heavily in debt, and you also have a budget that is absolutely not balanced. So I'm not sure
that's
the value
government. Is obvious. I mean, vacation time doesn't necessarily have an effect on how responsibly the government spends its money.
I'm not sure it doesn't, because you pay, if you take more vacation, you get, you know, it's a more taxing environment for the companies, because they get less, you know. I'm sure that what the right wing would say is if you give people more vacation, you would get less work done and it would be more costly for the companies. Isn't that the reason you don't get more vacation?
Yeah, but I don't think that has to do with the budget deficit. It's a pretty indirect line from one to the other.
Yeah,
I suppose you could say that giving more vacation might improve the economy because it would improve productivity, or vice versa.
Well, that's exactly
and,
what
and
it
if
is.
If you have a better
there?
Economy, you have. But frankly, the budget deficit is caused by the recession in 2008 and a limping economy. I don't know that.
What I'm
really
saying is, it's not like because of course it's easy to single out this one thing, but I'm talking as a general societal direction that you're taking, which is more to the right than what we do in Europe and in France in general. It's not like society is working so much better that this is a clearly superior way of approaching.
Oh, sure. You know? No, it doesn't prove it the other way. Absolutely. The argument is that the United States is more productive and more innovative than other countries. We could argue whether that's true or not, but that That's usually the assertion is, well, look at the United States. We have the most efficient, productive, and innovative society. And it's because of our low tax rates, our vacation policy, our work ethic, blah, blah, blah. You know, it goes on and on and on.
I guess
that's usually the way that argument runs.
Yeah, I guess it's pretty easy to see the validity in the argument of at least innovation. I mean, I've had very long discussions with – I can't remember if that's happened in this show, but discussing the innovation factor of the U.S. and the fact
that – You know why I think that is.
Sure, go ahead.
Because all of the crazy people left Europe and came to the United States. And crazy people are more innovative by nature because they're willing to think like crazy people instead of rationally and say, oh, well, that would never be possible. You know, they're like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm manic. And then they actually, in some cases, make it happen. In other cases, they end up in an institution. But, you know, Europe sort of had this selection bias where all the risk takers left to go explore the new world. And so you end up with an entire country full of people who are willing to take risks.
It's I guess it's possible. I think the reason I would give, if there is one, would be more the enabling of the – it's two things. It's easier to go ahead and do something in the U.S. That's, I think, true. And also, it's necessity. In France and in maybe other social – it's a combination of several things. But in France, if you're not providing for yourself, the government will probably provide for you in different ways. So, of course, you're not going to go to the extreme that you're actually going to need to get money for everything you do. But you have the cushion that will – you know, in the U.S., if you are laid off and you don't have health insurance, then you're really, really in trouble. So you have to go out and do something maybe you wouldn't have done otherwise, or do something daring.
I kind of feel like that argument can work the other way too, though, which is,
well,
if
theoretically,
I have
yes.
the safety net,
yeah.
I may quit my job to pursue my crazy idea. Because I know I have
yes,
a safety net. But if I don't, I'm going to stay in my boring job doing my boring things because I'm worried that I would get laid off and lose my health insurance if I risked it all to pursue my crazy idea.
I think in theory that's true. I think, but in reality, it doesn't really happen. I mean, it's very easy to do generalizations, but I seem to see that in reality, things usually don't work out that way. And I think there's another aspect which is very important, which I sort of started really seeing when I started dating the girl who is now my fiance, who is Finnish. It's the importance of Protestant work ethics, which are a constant drive for you to not abuse the system. There are things like in France, when you're laid off, and I'm sure, you know, other less honest French people would tell you that that's not true, but trust me, it does happen very often. When you're laid off, you take it easy for a few months. You know, you have a year and a half of unemployment benefits, sometimes more. So you're not going to start looking for work immediately at all. You can take 3, 6, 9 months to relax and maybe try something, but mostly, you know, stay on your couch and play the PlayStation. And at least in Scandinavia, it seems like that would be almost an unthinkable sin or something. And when you're laid off, oh my God, you find a new job now.
Right. But so, and they've got a huge safety net.
Oh yeah, even larger than ours. I mean, in Scandinavia, they are even more socialist than we are in France. And I was wondering, why does it work so much better? And I think one of the elements of the answer is that Protestant work ethics thing.
So. Yeah, it's a cultural thing, and I don't know if it's because of weather, but more the more northern you are in the northern hemisphere of the world anyway, the more northern you are, the more likely you are to have that driven work ethic, and the more southerly you are, the more likely you are to have a you know, sort of embrace life and enjoy things ethic.
Yeah, and it's, I guess it does make sense, right? It's like, you're, if you don't, you know, work too hard in I'm going to say
hot.
Spain, but it's hot and you're, no, but you're comfortable anyway. You know, it's hot,
yeah,
you're
right.
going
to. You don't have to worry about some, putting provisions aside for
exactly,
the winter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Whereas in the north of Finland, if you do that, winter comes and you die frozen and hungry.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
You know, it's, but it's very difficult for me to accurately judge which one is better, because I really, really think that it's important for everyone to enjoy their life. And I don't think that
right.
even if you have a job you love, which is my case, it's if I just had 2 weeks out of the year where I could do something different on that day, I think I would be somewhat unhappy. And is life really worth living if you're not going to be happy?
It's like that calorie diet where it's like, hey, you'll live a long time if you restrict your calories to this really low amount. And you're like, yeah, but I'll be miserable. I'll be hungry all the time.
I guess it is. And on that note, I'm going to McDonald's. All right. Last thing I wanted to mention about Turkey Day. Boy, we've veered off of that topic quite a bit.
Well, this Phileas Club is not Turkey Day, because we haven't had turkey on.
However, in France, we did have Black Friday, kind of.
And oh, it was, oh, really?
Well, not exactly. So here's what's happening. You obviously have had Black Friday forever.
Pretty much. I mean, it's really only been in the past decade or less that it's blown up as huge as it is in the U.S. now. But it's always been there. It's all, the day
right.
after Thanksgiving has always been a shopping day.
And we didn't really, you know, that's the kind of thing that we didn't even really know back then, you know, 10 years ago. And the reason why we're so aware of it now is that you have a lot of very successful companies that have web stores. And they do these promotions in the U.S. And, of course, it's a somewhat centralized administration of the store, so they're like, okay, we're gonna have that much off of these and these items in the store in the U.S. Let's do the same everywhere. So we actually have lots of pretty cool deals going up on the websites.
Interesting.
In France too. So we effectively have a portion of your Black Friday without, I guess, the portion that doesn't involve, you know, being trampled. I'm sorry.
It'd be noir, right?
Vendredi noir. Oh, I feel like that's
yeah.
Vendredi noir. I feel like that's something, some important date in history or something.
Well,
and
it is.
Not,
well, Black Friday is named after the Black Friday and the stock market crash, which I always.
Oh well, there
hilarious.
You go.
I
there
mean, that's,
you go.
That's what Black Friday originally refers to is the stock market crash in the '20s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. I knew that rang a bell. Yeah. So that's. A fantastic name. So explain to me this. How does it make sense for someone to get up at 4 a.m, be in the queue with a million other people, get trampled when the doors open for $30 off a $300, you know, vacuum cleaner?
It doesn't. It goes back to what I said about all the crazy people left other parts of the world and came here. I mean, and it's not even 4 a.m. anymore. It's midnight.
God.
Tons of stores were open at midnight. In fact, I saw the madness beginning to descend on Thursday night. I was up sitting on the couch next to Eileen. She's looking online, seeing these sales at one of the clothing stores she likes and realizing, oh, they're right down the highway, just a couple stops, and they're opening at midnight. You know, and I was like, are you thinking of going? She's like, I don't know. Like, you start to get kind of caught up in the hype.
Mm.
Like, oh, but it's 40% off. And then, of course, she very logically started to realize, well, wait a minute. You know, I can get the same deals by ordering online. Yeah,
sure.
I got to pay a little shipping, but I don't have to deal with the madness of all these people, you know, going crazy.
Mm.
But it sucks you in. I think it's not so much the savings and the deals as it is the spectacle of it, right? I mean, you get to tell the story of how you were there with all these people. It's like an event. and you get to talk about, and I got this, you know, amazing, I got this $5,000 TV for $2,000, or, you know, I got this.
So are the deals really that good? Because if it's that, these kinds of prices, I can understand it. If it's,
well,
you know.
You know what they do is they'll make a crazy deal, like a $5,000 TV was a horrible example. A $1,000 TV for $200. I saw that deal.
Okay.
But
and they have
five
two
of them.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
So only, and that's why people go and get in line, because you have to be the first in to get the five of those that they have on hand. It's all loss leader, right? They have these limited deals that get you in for the more regular, like 20%, 30% off everything in the store.
That seems like something I would never do, but who knows? Have you ever done it?
You know, when I was a kid, we always went to Famous Bar, which was a department store in St. Louis.
Very.
They opened at the crazy hour of 7 a.m., and we would go and go to the – they'd take one whole floor and turn it into like an animated winter wonderland. So as little kids, we'd go through there and we'd see, visit Santa at the end and get some toys. And then my mom would go shopping. So that was Black Friday in the 70s and early 80s. Now that it's become this crazy thing, I've never done it. I've never done the, like, go to the store at 4 in the morning. I've never gone out. I don't think I've even gone shopping on Friday in probably 20 years. On that Friday, that particular Friday. And yesterday, I set out not to spend any money all day because we didn't leave the house except to take the dogs for a walk. I did spend $4 because I got to the end of my Walking Dead comics that I've been meaning to catch up on. And so I had to buy the new one.
I
made one online purchase that was in no way related to the sales, but yeah,
you said to yourself, I will not spend a single dollar on anything. And
nah,
if we don't have any,
it wasn't quite that dogmatic. Okay. I planned ahead, bought groceries so that we wouldn't have to go anywhere. We could just like chill at home, which we never get to do. And then I realized in the morning, like, hey, you know what? I won't have to spend any money today. But then I did.
Okay.
I had to spend $2.99 for the new Walking Dead.
What did you think, by the way?
Oh, I love that comic. The comic far exceeds the television show, in
my
opinion.
Oh, thank you, sir. I've had a... I think I commented on a comment you did on Facebook or something.
Yeah.
A few weeks ago, I made a comment on Google Plus about the fact that The Walking Dead... Well, we're veering away from the Felix Club, but that's okay. We'll keep it short and then we're done.
Welcome to the TV-licious.
But I said that the first season of the TV show was great, except for the last two episodes. So basically two-thirds were really good. And the beginning of the second season really was basically like a subpar zombie movie on TV, and that was so much, you know, so not as good as the comic, which is incredible, that I was inviting everyone to read the comic, and because it was so far better than the TV show. And Veronica Belmont was very angry with me because she loved the TV show. And Robert Justin Young also commented that he loved it, and that he said, you know, Kirkman was saying that it was so much better like this because he didn't kill Shane. And, oh, sorry, spoiler. He didn't kill Shane, and it was so much better because it would allow him to develop, blah, 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 whatever. And now, a few weeks later, Robert Justin Young is saying, oh, the TV show
is horrible.
I love that
you're calling him Robert Justin Young.
Yeah.
Because he always calls other people the wrong name.
He does?
Yeah. It's Justin Robert, yeah.
Justin, oh, sorry.
Don't let that stop you. Keep calling him Robert.
Okay. Robert, hey, Bob. So Bob Young, he posted something on Google Plus or something, and he was saying, you know, the show is incredibly slow, and it's horrible, and I don't like it all that much anymore, and now I'm starting to like it a little bit more because it's coming back to what the comic is. So
yeah.
I'm happy to see that.
I felt like this last episode, last Sunday, they finally started to feel like the comic book again.
because it's really a comic about people, not really about zombies.
Right.
So, and the TV show was becoming about an adventure thing, not a relation thing.
Well, the it was all about relations, but they were really boring relations that were entirely predictable, not groundbreaking. Like, okay, different people have been thrown together under extreme stress, and how will they react? Which is what I like about the comic.
Agreed. And so I think I'm actually thinking I should have a discussion with Bob Young about this, because I think the
we should have you on Frame Rate. Brian Brushwood and I talk about Walking Dead pretty much every week.
Oh, sure. You know, I've actually never listened to Frame Rate, so I'll go and download a couple of episodes.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't think we did it this past episode because we ran short on time, but we will do what's called the spoiler zone at the end of Frame Rate, so that anybody who hasn't watched the series can stop and not get spoiled, and then we'll just go into what we thought of the recent episodes.
Cool. Oh, I'd love to be on that show. All right. I guess this is going to be the end for this show. It was slightly shorter than our usual shows, but not by much. But it was still very enjoyable to have you on, Tom. Thank you so much for waking up early after only a few days after the giant stuffing of turkey festival. Can you tell me and the fine folks listening where they can find you when you're not on this show?
Sure. I'll be at home. My website is tommerritt.com, two R's, two T's. So there's a page there where you can find all the shows that I do if you're curious and want to subscribe or just check them out, like Frame Rate, for instance. I'm the big one that I'm doing now that I'm really enjoying is with Robert Justin Young, called FSL Tonight. It's probably not that appealing.
Oh, is it your fantasy league thing?
It's a sports league made up of teams in the world of sci-fi and fantasy. So Mordor, Alderaan, Coruscant, Kronos.
I'm sorry, Vulcan. You're going to have to detail that a little bit more. What?
You
have fantasy people playing football?
So, you know, Luke Skywalker hasn't been getting played for the Alderaan Rebels recently. It's been a lot of controversy, and the ownership just made a change, fired Obi-Wan Kenobi, struck him down, and Yoda is taking over Skywalker's training and managing the team.
I don't think I need to add anything to that.
Yeah, and that's at FSLtonight.com. So TomMerritt.com, and on Twitter, go to Tom Merritt on Twitter, and you can find out what my actual Twitter name is there.
The mystery will be very enjoyable for you. Well, thank you very much. And to everyone listening, I will thank you also for listening to the show. And I will tell you that we will be back at the end of December for a new one. So please tune in. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.